If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a one-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the absolutely necessary shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Bulwark contributor and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center. I'm normally joined by my partner in crime, Elliot Cohen, the Robert E. Osgood Professor of Strategy at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. But Elliot is traveling, so I am soloing today with our very special guest, Owen Matthews, who has been a historian, a journalist, author of thrillers, which we'll get into in a minute, but also, most importantly, the author of the newly released book by HarperCollins, Overreach, The Inside Story of Putin's War Against Ukraine. Owen has been not just a historian and a journalist, but he's been the Moscow correspondent, bureau chief for Newsweek, and the Istanbul chief as well, I believe. And Owen, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Great to be on. Thank you, Eric.
Before we delve into Overreach in the book, you've spent a lot of time in Russia. You are essentially a native Russian speaker, studied at Oxford, but you have a family history and family roots in Russia. Could you tell our Shield listeners a little bit about how you came to spend so much time in Russia?
Yeah, I was born and raised in London, but my mother is indeed Russian, or as I used to tell people, my mother is Russian from Kharkiv. Now, that's actually become a rather controversial thing to say these days, because when my mother, who's still with us, I'm glad to say, was born in 1934, Kharkiv was the capital of Soviet Ukraine. So, in fact, whether Kharkiv is, whether you can, in fact, be Russian from Kharkiv has become something of a culture war within Ukraine, because, as we know, one of the great fault lines which underpins this war is that divide between Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers in Ukraine. And her family, my mother's family, the Bibikovs, are actually a really interesting example of how complicated that relationship is between Russia and Ukraine, and how complicated it's been historically. Because the Bibikovs were a Russian noble family whose involvement in Ukraine began in the end of the 18th century. And one of my ancestors was involved in Catherine the Great's annexation of the Crimean Peninsula, or when the Crimeans, the last Crimean Khan, basically surrendered his territory to the Russian Empire. Another one was a Russian governor of Kiev under Nicholas I in the 1830s and 1840s. But the point of all this history is to demonstrate a really important point, and that was that Kiev, Ukraine and Russia have historically been sufficiently culturally close that from the 18th century onwards, they had basically interchangeable elites. In other words, like, you know, senior members of the Ukrainian elite would go on to be courtiers in St. Petersburg, and vice versa, you know, Russians would come from St. Petersburg and be integrated into the, you know, into the administrative and cultural elite of Ukraine. But they're sufficiently different that when the imperial dominant partner, Russia, becomes weak, then there is sufficient difference for them to split. So what we're talking about is certainly a colonial situation whereby a powerful neighbor conquers and colonizes a smaller neighbor. But it's not like England and India. It's like England and Ireland. It's like England and Scotland. You actually have two countries that are actually, you know, rather close, but nonetheless different enough that now, you know, once conflict flares up, you get this, what you might call as, you know, the vanity of small differences, although it's not vanity. I mean, people, the Ukrainians take it very seriously, that they, that their culture has been suppressed for centuries, which is certainly true, by the way. The Russian Empire and the Soviets, the Soviet Union, did see danger in Ukrainianness. But the thing that's pertinent for the situation today, the important thing about all of this history and why we should be thinking about it today, is that there is a significant proportion of modern Ukrainian society that speaks Russian as their first language. Vladimir Zelensky, the president, literally speaks Russian at home to his kids. It's his native language. It's the native language of, you know, up to 40% of Ukrainian people. And what the war has done is drive a wedge between Ukrainian, as Russian speakers and people who identify as Russian. And one of Vladimir Putin's major mistakes when he launched that war is that he didn't see that there was a difference between those two things. He thought Russian speakers would be pro-Russian. That was maybe true, you know, before 2014 when Putin annexed Crimea, but it's definitely not true now.
I want to get into all of that, but I'm just curious. Actually, my maternal grandparents were from Odessa and, of course, were Russian speakers. And if they were alive today and you asked them, I'm sure they would say we were Russians. They wouldn't identify themselves as Ukrainian. They left in 1919. But I'm curious, did you grow up speaking Russian at home? Because I had two Russian-speaking parents, but the children were all encouraged to study French. Russian became the privileged language of adult communication in our household. And I only started studying Russian when I was in my early 30s on my way to Moscow as a part of the U.S. Embassy in the late 80s there. But I'm just curious, did you grow up speaking it or did you study at school?
I did grow up speaking it. Yes, that's right. And my mother spent her career as a teacher of Russian language and literature. So I had I had the full sort of Soviet, you know, style, you know, homeschool experience of having Russian grammar drilled into me.
But that must have been a great asset for you as a journalist, both in your time at the Moscow Times and with Newsweek, in terms of your access to Russian officials and also just, you know, Russian citizens in day-to-day life.
Yes, that's certainly true. And actually, yes, I'm filled with admiration for that. There are foreigners that speak near fluent Russian, and I frankly don't know how they do it from scratch. It's an amazingly difficult language. But I have an unfair advantage, indeed. It's literally my mother tongue.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, before we get into the war, and I want to go back to 2014, but also obviously the current war that you write about so brilliantly, frankly, in this book. Talk a little bit about your observation of the evolution of the Putin, you know, regime. I mean, quite famously, I worked in a American administration where President Bush 43 met with Vladimir Putin in 2001 in the spring in Slovenia and said, I've looked into this man's eyes and seen his soul, and I liked what I saw, and I could do business with him. And a lot of us winced, frankly, when we heard him say that. But there was a sense of optimism about the Putin regime initially, but it's gone on a trajectory that has taken Russia in a very dark direction. I'm just curious, when did you see this dark direction developing? How did you see the whole trajectory going during your time observing?
It's interesting. For a start, we actually need to recognize, it's important to recognize that there is a trajectory, that Putin has changed, and that actually Putin of, into whose eyes Bush looked is a different Putin to the Putin today. Because I think there's a tendency, I remember having a big debate, argument, I would say, with Radoslav Sikorski, the former Polish Interior and Defense Minister, during an Intelligence Squared debate a few months ago. And for people like Sikorsky, who have always been extremely hawkish about Putin, he has said that, you know, basically, I knew that Putin was a Russian imperialist from like the 2000s. It was clear to me that this, you know, plan of imperial domination was always Putin's agenda. Now, actually, I don't think that's the case. And I think it's actually demonstrably not the case. I don't think Putin, or rather, let's unpack this. Putin was always a Soviet nostalgist in certain ways. He always had a sense of grievance about how Russians who had been stuck outside the borders of the Soviet Union were treated. And if anyone knows a single quote from Vladimir Putin, it's from his statement to the Russian Duma in November 2005, when he famously said that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century. But people forget the first half of that sentence. What Putin said back in 2005 is, for the millions of Russians who found themselves trapped outside the borders of their homeland, comma, the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century. Now, that's a kind of different message. I mean, it's the point is, I think, that for a long stretch of Putin's career, his priority was, in fact, to be accepted by the West, to be a member of Western clubs. He was enormously proud and made a huge fuss of hosting the G8 in St. Petersburg. He was extremely sensitive always about being sort of left out and not consulted. But nonetheless, always he would continue through, you know, hypocritically perhaps, he would always continue to refer to my Western partners. I mean, there was a long period of Putin's career, I would say probably until about 2013, 2012, when Putin was convinced that there was basically a deal to be done, that there was respect to be won, that Putin could integrate Russia into the world on more respectful terms. I think that broke down when he returned from his four-year hiatus for his third time as president, when Putin returned as president in 2012 and was confronted with, for the first time in his career, massive popular demonstrations. And I think to him, that was because he's sincerely convinced, he was sincerely convinced then, that this was the work of the State Department, you know, of your colleagues, Ambassador Edelman.
Well, I was out of government then, so I don't take any responsibility for it. But yes, it was Secretary Clinton, I think, who he blamed, actually.
Right. Sure. And for him, this was a clear sign that the West were not willing to accept him on his own terms. And by that time, of course, in 2012, he'd already invaded Georgia in 2008. So, you know, already the wheels have sort of more or less come off the bus of cooperation. But nonetheless, the Obama administration did attempt a final reset with the Kremlin. But I think the change comes when Putin decides that the West wants him gone and his regime over. And from then on, he starts to move in a pretty inexorably anti-Western direction. And the ruling passion, the ruling sort of fixed idea in his mind, I think, is that he is fighting against a concerted Western plot to overthrow him.
It seems to me that that maybe dating it a little late, in the sense that in 2004-5, with the Orange Revolution, he clearly is taken aback by the Yushchenko-Yanukovych election in 2004, and then the protests that put Yushchenko, forced a second running and put Yushchenko in, the beginning of the color revolutions. And then later, his speech to the Duma, which he talks about Comrade Wolf, referring to the United States, and then the 2007, of course, Munich Security Conference speech, which also seems like a declaration of war is maybe too strong, but certainly a Jeremiad against the U.S.-led, you know, unipolar world. I wonder what you make of the theories of my late colleague, Karen Dawisha, and Catherine Belton, that really Putin's regime from the get-go is sort of, if not a conspiracy, but a sort of concerted effort by elements of the security services, particularly the KGB and particularly those around Putin in St. Petersburg, to take back the Russian state from the hands of the quote-unquote Democrats, you know, into whose hands it's fallen after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Do you think that's too conspiratorial, or is there some element of truth in that?
No, I think that's entirely on the money. I mean, I think it's very clear that that, you know, right from the beginning, in fact, even from the days when Putin, you know, before Putin makes it to the presidency, already as prime minister, he surrounds himself with his closest allies. You know, from the 1990s, politically in the presidential administration, then as head of the FSB, then as prime minister, and then as president, have been the same tiny bunch of guys who he's been working with since the 1970s. I mean, that's really unprecedented in the history of government, or barely precedented, that actually a ruling elite will have actually been, you know, known each other for nearly half a century and worked with each other for nearly half a century. And the KGB takeover of the state was already complete when Putin came to power, because he immediately put some of his most powerful, installed some of his old KGB, basically filled the key positions, particularly in the security state, with his old cronies. And the difference was that I think in the early 2000s, there was a conflict, and there's, you know, every administration has different voices, whether it's Russian or whatever it may be. There was a certain pragmatic, what has been variously described as sort of, you know, technocratic or liberals, or I mean, I don't think they're particularly liberal, but the people who are generally described as the technocrats in the Putin regime were at least recognizably post-Soviet, unlike Putin himself and his cronies, Nikolai Patrushev, who's the Secretary of the Security Council, and Alexander Bortnikov, who's head of the FSB. These have completely remained in their outlook, in their paranoia, in their fundamental ignorance and lack of understanding of the mechanisms of how the world and the West works. These are total Homo Soveticus people. There were pragmatists in the room, and I think indeed you're right in identifying the Orange Revolutions as a kind of turning point. That sort of was a major trigger for the paranoia. But already, I mean, the Putin administration in as early as 2002 and 2003, when they were moving against Mikhail Khodorkovsky and finally arrested him in 2003, you know, already that's, you know, pure KGB tactics at work. So there was never any doubt of whether they were really whether the KGB, you know, had taken charge. I think there is some debate about what they wanted, where they wanted to get to. And you mentioned the 2007 Munich speech, which indeed was a sort of considered a real landmark moment. It was Putin's answer to that series of color revolutions, which Putin himself and his inner circle construed as, you know, Western-inspired salami-tapped tactics to undermine the Russia's power and influence over its near abroad. But there's a really important point, a non-trivial point, about the Munich speech, is that actually, if you read it, you see that what he's appealing, he's indeed railing against American hegemony, but he is appealing to Europe to make its own arrangements with him. So, I mean, it seems now like, you know, after all this sort of storm and drying, it's like a sort of, you know, but it's actually more than an obscure historical point. I think the relationship with America broke down long before, because he believed that it was America that was exclusively and mostly behind the color revolutions. I think he held out much more hope that he could build bridges with the Europeans. because with the Europeans had obviously a more fractionalized leadership, that he could make deals with individual governments, divide and rule, and so on. So, from right up basically, I think, until more or less 2020, when the whole sort of avalanche of events that leads to war. I think there was hope that he could do deals with Europe.
I want to turn to 2014, and you've mentioned, of course, in 2008, Putin invades Georgia. That's, of course, in the immediate aftermath of the Bucharest summit, which debated the question of Georgian and Ukrainian membership in NATO, even though in those days, under President Yanukovych, there was not much of a push in Ukraine for NATO membership. And the NATO summit came to after intense debate, because there was a lot of opposition to Georgia and Ukraine as potential NATO members. The actual issue at stake at the time was whether to give the membership action plan, which had only been awarded to countries that ultimately had become members of NATO, to Georgia and Ukraine. The opposition from France and Germany blocked that. But the compromise they came up with was to not give them the membership action plan, but to, in the communique, state authoritatively that Georgia and Ukraine would someday become members of NATO, which obviously, was like waving a red flag at Putin. But it seems like the 2014 seizure of Crimea and then the destabilization of eastern Ukraine, the Donbas, Lugansk, and Donetsk, is really a function of what appears to be Ukraine's turn towards Europe. It's not even NATO. It's the EU that becomes the sort of potential causus belli for Putin. Can you explain to our listeners how all that transpired and how it set the stage for 2022?
Well, you're completely right that if you ask a Russian, or if you were to ask Putin, NATO's aggression, quote unquote aggression, and its inexorable expansion are like front and center. It's the main thing that they always talk about. But in fact, one of the most revealing quotes from Putin's inner circle was this guy, Viktor Zolotov, who's a former head bodyguard to Putin, who now heads the Russian National Guard, who said a few years ago, Ukraine isn't important. Ukraine happens to be where the border between Russia and America lies. So NATO is really a proxy for American expansion in Russia's mind. And the problem is that everything that the Russians say about NATO expansion, factually, is true. NATO did expand. There were certain assurances that were given, certainly not formally, but definitely informally. There's been a lot of academic writing about this, the sources, back in 1991. There were undoubtedly some informal assurances given by the United States that NATO would not expand. It expanded. There was the Bucharest summit, which indeed declared definitively that NATO would enlarge, and so on. All those things are factually true. However, what the difference between what I or most Western commentators would say was that actually, in practical terms, I don't think there was really any real possibility or probability of Ukraine ever joining NATO, not least because there is actually in the constitution of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, there is a clause that says that no country with disputed borders can join. Even legally, right, Ukraine could never join. So the question becomes, why does NATO actually continue to engage so provocatively in with Ukraine? And here you sort of really get into the thick weeds, because in fact the answer is, you know better than I because of your experience at the Department of Defense and so on, but there is a distinction between NATO, the rather small Brussels-based bureaucracy, and the actual strategic desire of the members of NATO. So, the people who are in NATO headquarters, have you know, need to push their pens. They need to think of, you know, this framework of engagement and that program. And you know, there's a lot of, you know, bureaucratic noise that comes out, which gives the impression that NATO is actively expanding. But actually, unfortunately, and this is something that's almost impossible to explain to Russians because they dismiss it as just sort of bluster. But the reality is that actually the real engagement of NATO in Ukraine was extremely limited. And when you have that phone call between Trump and Zelensky back in 2019, where Trump appears to, you know, dangle draw an equivalence between continued military aid and Zelensky's help with getting, you know, dishing the dirt on Hunter Biden, how much money are they really talking about? And the answer is $400 million. So, I mean, given that the U.S. spends about over $2 billion a day on defense, that's what, like 5 hours of U.S. defense spending? It's like, you know, sofa change.
Yeah, yes, I think the technical term of art in the Pentagon for that is budget dust.
Budget dust, well, exactly. But to answer your question about the annexation of Crimea, I think it was... Clearly, the decision on Putin's part was made very quickly. There was no real lead up to this. There was no deep need either in Crimea or Russia to annex Crimea. It had never been a thing, to put it bluntly. It was not in any way in anyone's consciousness to do that. It was done on a whim. And I think that the proximate cause was indeed in order to stop Ukraine from joining NATO. But actually, I think the primary tactical consideration was to actually prevent a future Ukrainian administration from canceling the lease on Sevastopol, which is the Russian naval base, which was shared, by the way, between Ukraine and Russia, and was on Ukrainian territory, but leased by Russia. So the fear of NATO expansion, of Ukraine becoming, you know, part of NATO, was, you know, absolutely central to Putin's thinking all along. And by the way, it's not that massively different from Jeff Kennedy's thinking about Cuba. Khrushchev's missiles on Cuba were functionally, or the prospect of Cuba joining the Warsaw Pact, by the way, which was discussed, was considered to be an unacceptable risk to America's underbelly. So, I mean, the logic is the same.
I mean, I would say, though, that the circumstances are somewhat different in the sense that, well, to go back to some of your earlier comments, you know, my Johns Hopkins colleague, Mary Cerotti, would be quite cross with me if I didn't point out that, you know, a lot, since she's quoted by you in the book, that these assurances which Russia got about NATO not expanding one inch to the east were in the context of the unification of Germany. And it wasn't within the purview of the Bush 41 administration to promise anything about what its successors might do. I was actually a party to the negotiations between Strobe Talbot and Yevgeny Primakov about the NATO-Russia Founding Act in 1997 that paved the way for the first enlargement of NATO. And it was, the attempt was being done to do it in a way that was cooperative with Russia. And in any event, in the period we're talking about, 2014, there wasn't a single U.S. tank in Europe, you know, at the time of the seizure of Crimea. So, you know, whatever fever dream Putin had about Ukrainian near-term membership in NATO, which, as you and I have both been discussing, was not really in the cards, it was also in the context of a NATO that posed no military threat per se to Russia. I mean, you can imagine a perceived political threat in the context of all the things we've been discussing, but the military threat just wasn't there.
I'm not sure that Russians would see it that way. Obviously, they didn't. I mean, the point is that when you have a country that is, you know, straddles your border without any natural feature, without any kind of natural border, and shares a 1,600 kilometer long border with Russia. I mean, it's an enormous border, a land border. When that joins a military alliance that is literally formed for the purpose of containing you, then it's not completely unreasonable for the Russians to be concerned about it.
Yeah, but that wasn't in the that was not on the table, Owen. Right? It wasn't in the cards.
But they thought that it was, and it was. You know, they were not totally deluded. I mean, they were. The statement after the Bucharest summit was pretty unequivocal, right, that actually Ukraine would eventually join. So the question is, you know, what could NATO have done? I mean, if we just turn this whole debate on its head, right, at what point could NATO have said, like, oh, you know, sorry, we don't mean it. You know, let's just back off. You know, we're not going to do that. The problem is that both sides consider the other to be constantly escalating. And so so all the logic that I described about, you know, the view from Russia that they think that NATO is expanding, it's encroaching, the view from NATO is precisely the same. What they see is a NATO is a Russia that's getting more belligerent, is building up its troops, is in 2008, you know, you have a seminal moment where you have, you know, the invasion of Georgia, of not just the breakaway republics of Georgia, but actually Georgia proper. Right. Tanks on the road to Tbilisi. I was there. So the question is, you know, the whole tragedy of the situation is that it's a dialogue of the deaf, with both sides seeing constant escalation on the other's part. And crucially, the missing part is actually sort of good faith dialogue on the part of the Kremlin, because actually, as we know, Putin lives in an information bubble. He's extremely paranoid. He's surrounded by people who are actually, if anything, more paranoid and more aggressive than himself. So you just who are also completely convinced that their lifelong main adversary, i.e. the United States, is hell-bent on their destruction. And in that context, there's actually almost nothing, realistically, I think, that either the United States or NATO could really have done to staunch that or to reassure the Russians. And, you know, especially when you see their kind of, you know, completely sort of Looney Tunes demands in January and February, as discussed in Geneva between your colleague
Tony Blinken,
Blinken and Lavrov, and it's completely off the wall. Like, NATO should, like, you know, retreat to 1997 positions, 2007 positions. Right. I mean, it's completely nuts. So this is nothing close to serious diplomacy. It's just you know, projection of this sort of constant resistance and anger and resentment against NATO expansion. I would think the one thing that actually could have been done, and actually almost was done, because this is kind of on the table in the run-up to the 2022 war, was some kind of non-NATO security arrangement for Ukraine. And Zelensky did indicate clearly that he would accept that. He said that, like, you know, we don't have to join NATO, but we just have to have security guarantees. And that should have been fine, except your interlocutor is not looking for fine. He's looking for something else. He's just looking for, you know, more evidence that his enemy is trying to trick him.
You talk about in the book, I think, you know, brilliantly, sort of what brought Putin to go to war in 2022. I mean, I suppose we could, when you say what could NATO have done, I mean, one thing in 2014, given the fact that Russia had at that point violated both its bilateral treaty with Ukraine by seizing Crimea, but also the multilateral Budapest memorandum, which you talk about in the book. The assurances given to Ukraine when Ukraine gave up its claim, and it was a claim because the nuclear weapons left on its territory after the breakup of the Soviet Union still remained in the hands of the Russian strategic rocket forces, but there could have been a war in 1992 or 93 over these weapons as they were being withdrawn. There was an agreement, the Russians violated it. could NATO, the U.S., NATO, the West, responded more firmly to what happened in 2014? Would that have made a difference, do you think?
Sure. Of course it would have. I think it would have. But again, it's we get into that sort of, you know, high school history debate. You know, at what point, you know, should the Allies have stopped? Or should the French have stopped the Germans marching into the Ruhr? Right. You know, should we have, you know, drawn the line at the Sudetenland? Should we have drawn the line at Munich, right, and so on? At Czechoslovakia. You know, at what point could you have stopped? I think the as a historian, I'm rather wary of historical analogies. So yeah, I don't think Hitler is actually a particularly good historical analogy, because, you know, Hitler had his plan for reversing Versailles and winning his Lebensraum, you know, right from the get-go. He describes it completely. He has like literally a written manifesto in the form of his prison memoir, Mein Kampf, which is not Putin's case. Putin kind of like gets to that extremely aggressive position in the end. The thing that the situation in 1914, so Freudian slip, 1914, in 2014 was ambiguous in one important sense. And if we, I think Putin has proved amply with his invasion of 2022 that he is definitely not the strategic genius that many commentators, including myself, considered him to be, falsely credited him with being. But there is one thing that Putin did very consistently and very smartly, and that is that all of his military operations, his overseas military operations, were in a kind of moral gray zone. So, you know, in 2014, okay, he annexes Crimea, but on the other hand, it's bloodless. It's also clear that, you know, for all the illegality of the annexation and the subsequent referendum and the Crimean Tatars being beaten up and that. So I think it would be very hard to argue that the population of Crimea would be, were opposed to the Russians, to becoming Russian. People tend to forget that in 1992, the Ukrainians, the Crimeans voted not just to leave the Soviet Union, they did leave, but earlier, they had also voted to leave Ukraine. Sorry, this is 1991. The population of Crimea voted to recreate the sort of semi-independent Soviet or autonomous Republic of Crimea in the spring of 1991. So that was a gray zone. Attacking Syria, sending warplanes into Syria, like, you know, he's supporting the Assad regime, but he's attacking ISIS. You know, in Donbass, the population seems to be not pro-Kiev. There seems to be some real sympathy. I was in Donbass at the time. I mean, there certainly was some sympathy for Moscow and hostility to Kiev. So, like, with every stage, he's kind of kept on the shadow side. He's like, it's always shades of gray. You know, none of these things taken discreetly is anything that the United States or the Western world would fight World War III for. You know, whether Crimea is Russian or Ukrainian, it's, you know, as George Clooney brilliantly says in Syriania, yes, no, it's complicated. You know, it's always complicated. But then suddenly in 2022, it's not complicated. He just steps out of the gray zone into the black zone, and suddenly all bets are off. It's a terrible strategic mistake. But to go back to your original question of what could have been done in 2014, well, what could have been done in 2014? We could have imposed stronger sanctions. That's certainly true. The Germans could not, having said at the beginning of in the aftermath of Crimea, of the Crimean annexation, Angela Merkel insists that this will not stand, that this is unacceptable, that, you know, territorial land grabs are not part of our sort of European civilization, 2014, and then 14 months later signs a $10 billion gas deal with Gazprom. Right. I mean, they could have not done that, for instance. So, you know, in the end, the message is that, you know, what Putin hears is, you know, frankly, these Europeans are just, you know, their words, their rhetoric is just, you know, blah, right, blah.
It's all lip service, essentially, as far as he can tell.
Yeah, and so in that sense, there is a sort of fatal weakness that's been demonstrated there. But on the other hand, it's not that the Europeans did not act. What they thought they were doing with Minsk I and Minsk II was actually creating a framework whereby they would actually, the sort of central plank of Minsk, of both Minsk agreements, was a referendum in the rebel republics. You know, that seems pretty sensible, right? I mean, why not do that? They thought they'd fixed the problem. And furthermore, it's very easy to forget now that actually in right up until 2020, the position of the Kremlin concerning the rebel republics of the Donbass was that they were part of Ukraine.
Right.
They repeated that often. Like, this is Ukraine. We want them in Ukraine. I mean, the reason why they wanted them in Ukraine was, you know, 100% evil. They wanted them to, like, you know, mess up Ukraine. They wanted, like, them as a thorn in the side of Ukraine. They wanted them as, like, a drag anchor to stop them going westwards. They supported the territorial integrity of Ukraine minus Crimea for all kinds of, like, bad imperial reasons, but nonetheless, they never said, this is our territory. And that changes very abruptly at the beginning of 2022.
Let's go there. What you, as I said in the book, you, I think, have a masterful explanation of what it is that leads Putin, as you say, to move from the gray zone into the black zone. Tell us, you know, recount a little bit, you know, the factors you see that lead him to do this in the 2020 to 2022 period, and the timing, if you could comment a little bit about what is it that drives the timing of all this.
Well, I think five things happen. He starts the war because he thinks he can win it. Why does he think he can win it? Because America has just been humiliated in Afghanistan. Angela Merkel has stepped down as the Chancellor of Germany. He's spent 8 years investing 7% of GDP in his army. The only time the Russian army and the Ukrainian army have actually met in the field in Ilovaevsk in 2014 and in Debaltseve in 2015, the Russians have kicked the Ukrainians' backside. The Zelensky, he believes, is a weak leader. And furthermore, he is convinced that the European sanctions, and he's built up a war chest large enough to support sanctions. That wasn't five, that was seven. But anyway, the point is, but underlying all of that, the reason why he decides that only an invasion will do is the more important question. I think because by the beginning of 2020, it's clear that the Russian strategy that we just talked about, that having the Donbass republics inside Ukraine, messing things up, and preventing that westward drift, that strategy that they've been trying to pursue for, at that point, 6 years, isn't working. It's not working. There's just basically no way that they can make that happen. Largely, in fact, not because the Donbass republics don't want to vote. They do want to vote. In fact, they agreed to have a vote in 2019. It's the ultranationalists in Kiev that are stopping Zelensky in October 2019 from doing that. So basically, by the beginning of 2020, they just think, you know, it's over. We need to come up with a better solution. And I think the real tipping point was, why invasion as opposed to sort of engagement, disruption, all the sort of dirty tricks that Russia's been up to since, arguably, since 1991, but acutely since 2014, is what happens in Belarus. And actually, I think it's one of the flaws in the book is I don't really write quite as much as I should, or emphasize that quite as much as I should, is that actually in the summer, in August of 2020, Belarus is rocked by these enormous and extremely violent demonstrations involving hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, far worse than anything that that Putin's ever saw in 2011 or 2012, with a much smaller population. So therefore, actually, you have like 10% of the population out on the streets eventually. And that's really, and again, entirely consistently with his reaction to the Velvet Revolutions, to the Maidan Revolution and so on, Putin thinks that this is like the dastardly hand of America, just and you know, the salami has taken another slice. And I think at that fatal juncture, where like the whole strategy, Russia's strategy in with Ukraine is breaking down, Belarus protests are breaking out, you know, overlapping that, COVID breaks out and Putin goes into like deep isolation and spends, as far as we can tell, he's, you know, spends at least 2 years in like sort of deep paranoid COVID isolation, you know, not just sitting behind 6 meter tables, but actually, you know, forcing everyone who meets him in, you know, to quarantine for at least 10 days. I mean, this is well documented.
Right.
Spending hundreds, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on like sort of, you know, COVID sanitation facilities and quarantine facilities around him.
You know, you talk in the book, you cover very well the events of the war, the initial thrust towards Kyiv, the frustration of that by the Ukrainians. Just inter alia, I don't want to go down this particular rabbit hole, but as a former U.S. ambassador to Finland who has spent some time studying the Winter War of 1939-40, it's like, you know, deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra said. I mean, it looks very similar in military terms. But you also talk then about the Russian offensive in Severodonetsk in the spring of 22, and then the counteroffensives in the fall by Ukraine that ultimately drive the Russians out of Kharkiv province back into Luhansk, and then the, not, I wouldn't say equally successful, but the forced evacuation of Kherson by the Ukrainians. And when your book ends, I mean, even though it, obviously you finished writing several months ago, the truth is the battlefield hasn't moved much since then. So what do you think the prospects are here? Of course, a lot of discussion, given all the U.S. military assistance and training of Ukrainian forces, of a forthcoming offensive. There's been the constant assault by Prigozhin's Wagner group, private military company, along with MOD troops in Bakhmut, which Ukrainians seem to have decided to make that an effort to just trit and waste the Russian forces to some effect. I mean, losses have been quite astonishing. What do you see going forward? How does, to borrow the phrase that David Petraeus asked Linda Robinson, one of your colleagues in the Fourth Estate, about the war in Iraq, tell me how this ends.
Yeah, I think several things are clear. Zelensky has one shot. I don't think there's going to be, you know, a spring 2024 Ukrainian offensive. I don't think there's going to be a sort of winter 23-24 shopping round by Zelensky. I think the in that sense, I think Putin's calculation that the West will lose interest or will start to sue for peace, at least, is unfortunately pretty well founded. You already see, you know, the cracks are already running in the Republican Party, although it's actually still a minority of GOP senators and congressmen who have signed up to that letter. You know, it's still sort of the Marjorie Taylor Greens of this world who are still, you know, passionately opposed. But already, you know, Ron DeSantis, you know, he criticized aid to Ukraine, and then he kind of uncriticized it in the sort of sorry kind of way. But nonetheless, you know, the Overton window, the window of possible debate is definitely moving against Ukraine in the United States political discourse. That's really clear. The crack's also running in Europe, and the crack is not, you know, is not that people are going to suddenly start hating Ukraine and loving Putin. That's not the split. The split is between peace and justice. And you have, you know, large constituencies who are not pro-Putin, by the way, or not anti-Ukraine, but they are just pro-peace. In certainly in the Italian right, In Germany, it's caused major economic damage, especially the German chemical industries. I mean, Europe's energy prices have now gone down to pre-war levels, or they've been down there for some time. But nonetheless, pre-war levels were still high, almost three times higher than they had been in the 2 years prior to that, in 2019. So, there's that debate over peace versus justice is, do we just bring an end to this war, end the bloodshed, and just draw the line where, along the line of control, Korea style? Or do we, as a shrinking proportion of Europeans believe, continue to fight to the bitter end and ensure that Putin is punished, that justice is served, that that, as Zelensky has called for, that the Russia gets thrown out of all of the territory it's taken? But I tend to agree with the assessments that we've seen on the Discord leaks, that actually the United States government appears to be somewhat skeptical about the prospect of a full Ukrainian victory. And you can kind of see why, because if you just look at the numbers, at the metrics of it, there have been approximately 50 Leopard tanks delivered from 12 Challenger 2 tanks from Britain. I think it's up nearly up to 50 Leopard tanks from Germany, the Netherlands, and so on. Russia still has, even by US DoD estimates, at least half of its main battle tank fleet still intact, and that's at least 1,400 main battle tanks. So, the Ukrainians have got 50 more and tanks, and the Russians, versus 1,500, and they're attacking. The Russians are defending. We know how that goes. I'm not a military expert, but I mean, obviously, I speak to people who are. The country is flat, but actually has been deeply defended by the Russians. So, unfortunately, I don't really see a realistic prospect of Ukraine actually taking back all the territory that it has lost to Russia. It will take back a lot. It will take back as much as it can. But already you see, even today, I just read that the EU has called for, the EU's foreign policy chief has called for Ukraine to negotiate with Russia, quote unquote, from a position of strength. I mean, decoded, what does that mean? It means, give it a go, take as much as you can. And then, we're just, pulling the plug on this at a certain point, which is not a terrible outcome, by the way, because there have been several Ukrainian politicians, including Zelensky's first foreign minister, Vadim Pristaiko, who's now, who was fired in 2019 and was punished by being sent to London as Ukraine's ambassador. But in 2019, he was... Pristaiko said in 2019... that actually we need to discuss whether there is any good that's going to come to Ukraine from owning Donbass.
Yeah.
Maybe we should just amputate it like a gangrenous limb and just like say goodbye to Donbass. If they don't want to be with us, then they don't want to be with us. Like, fine, we should prepare ourselves for the fact that he was talking about it in the context of a vote, of course, not in the context of an armed aggression, to be fair to Vadim. But that's a genuine question. Why don't they just let Donbass go and just and the answer the Ukrainians will give is moral hazard and practical hazard, that we leave an enemy, wounded and humiliated, but not incapacitated. And furthermore, we're rewarding aggression because because Putin will still have end up with the Ukrainian land. So in that sense, it's a somewhat insoluble solution. But I think the only answer is essentially a Korean type situation, because no Ukrainian leader, whether Zelensky or anybody else, can ever survive signing off on a land for peace deal. That's completely inconceivable. It's not unsurvivable for any Ukrainian leader to do that.
Particularly after the last year and the war crimes and the horrors that have been visited on Ukrainians by the occupying Russian forces, I think make that all the more the case. We're really running low on time. And before we lose you, there are two other topics I want to quickly get into. One is, I'm going to read the epigram from, I think it's the last chapter of your book, which is a quotation from the Russian poet and critic Dmitry Bykov, in which he says, "The Putin regime is all about stealing wealth that is buried under the earth, and one of the deepest buried resources in Russia is the profound conservatism of its people, their lack of education, loyalty, resistance to change, ignorance and hostility to anything foreign or new, is also a kind of oil laid down in very deep and ancient layers. It is something valuable that can be mined and exploited like any other natural resource." And I read that quotation because when one watches Russian TV news, when you see Margarita Simonyan or your old playmate Solovyov, whose television show you frequently would appear when you were in Moscow, and I think it's only fair to tell our listeners that you were upholding truth and right very vociferously in those conversations, which is even in those days, kind of surprising that they would let that go on, although it tells you a little bit about how much things have changed. But now what you see in the nightly on Russian television is precisely an effort to mine what Bykov talks about, really frighteningly eliminationist, xenophobic rhetoric. And I wonder, since you have so much experience on Russian television, what do you make of that, and what does it portend for the future of Russia?
Some things haven't changed. The sort of hysterical anti-Ukrainian rants were exactly the same when I would go on. I guess that was 2017, 18, 19. I went, I did nearly 100 shows of that nature. The reason why I did it was because journalistically it was rather interesting to actually talk to these people. They're definitely not first rank people, but they're, people like, the heads of Senate committees, Duma faction chairman, deputy heads, deputy ministers, those kind of, it's not the bag carrying class, it's not the top class, but there are people who are sort of in serious senior positions in the Russian government. So journalistically, it was kind of interesting to be, in the room with them, and we would chat, and it was basically a way of sort of sneakily interviewing all these guys. Secondly, I did it because I was interested in how the Russian propaganda machine worked, and thirdly, I was interested to actually, if not me, then who? Because I speak fluent Russian and I'm able to debate, including under that incredibly high pressure environment where everyone's like screaming at you. It's really very adversarial. But anyway, to answer your question, back then, the reason why they got me on as a foreign journalist, I said things, by the way, because I was a foreigner that no Russian would be allowed to go on and say. For instance, almost every time I went on these shows, it became like a sort of almost a signature thing. It's like, I would say, like, by the way, you do realize that, the regime is, invading Syria or doing this thing in Donbass because to distract you from the fact that they're sort of wholesaling, stealing your country from you. You know that, right? And it would be sort of, and no one ever told me what I should or shouldn't say. But because I was able to say things that were sort of outrageously anti-Putin all the time, actually, because they're smart, because this is produced by extremely smart, very cynical people, my opposition, in fact, as I came to realize, kind of actually reinforced the illusion that this was an objective show. I mean, and they could say, like, oh, look, but we have Owen Matthews of Newsweek on, and here he is telling us that, Vladimir Putin is robbing our country blind, and this is all just a distraction. And unfortunately, my opposition on that show kind of validated that illusion, which is why I stopped doing it, in fact. But as you rightly observe, after the beginning of the war, it just sort of kicked into a different key. It just became, frankly hysterical and, terrifyingly so. The question is actually, and it's not entirely clear to the extent to which this is entirely top down. And having spent, having been on these shows and talked to the producers and, sort of had dinner with them and sort of know them somewhat socially, these, talented, cynical people who put this appalling propaganda product together, you start to realize that actually for most of the time, they're kind of just winging it. They don't get a phone call every morning from the Kremlin and say, like, today, comrade, the party line is ABC. No, actually, no. And quite often they get it wrong. They go too far, even. So they're all just sort of like a bunch of needy school kids kind of clamoring for the attention of teacher, you know, by trying to do and say the right thing.
Oh, and we're going to lose you in a couple of minutes, but I do want to, at least for our listeners, touch on not just this terrific work of nonfiction that you've produced, but also some works of fiction that you've written, Black Sun and Red Traitor. Black Sun, I believe, is about Andrei Sakharov. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what it was that drew you to the thriller genre and why you decided to do that in addition to, you know, writing these, you know, quite scholarly books that you've written on Stalin's children and other topics, Nikolai Rezanov and others?
Yeah, it was poverty, I must. I just did it for fun and cash, is the honest answer.
Well, that's fair enough. But I want to commend them to our listeners as well, since this is not a GoFundMe campaign, but we need to do everything we can to support good journalism these days. Our guest has been Owen Matthews. Owen, thank you so much for your time. I suspect as this goes on, you'll have to write an epilogue for the paperback edition of Overreach, the inside story of Putin's war against Ukraine, published by HarperCollins. And when you do the epilogue, we'll have to have you back.
Thank you. It'll be my great pleasure and privilege.